Welcome to a podcast of The Mike Novak Show. Don't forget that you can listen to Mike live on Sundays from 8 to 10 a.m. on Chicago's Progressive Talk, AM and FM.
The following program is a paid production from Mike Novak, LLC, which is a fancy way of saying that we really don't want to have much to do with this show. So, because, you know, Novak spent a little bit too much time out in the garden, if you know what I mean. And NewsWeb Radio Company doesn't agree with most things he says. Especially when he talks about perennials. Oi!
Less than a minute now.
Tool time for 200.
This term for a long-handled gardening tool can also mean an immoral pleasure seeker. Ken.
What's a hoe?
No. Whoa! 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 They teach you that in school in Utah, huh? Al.
What's a rake?
A rake is right. You select, Al. 400.
Live from the beautiful Showcase Studios on South Pulaski Road, just across the street from the 53A bus stop and in between Paco's Tacos and Zaka Tacos, it's The Mike Novak Show, Chicago's only locally broadcast green gardening and environment program. Heard every Sunday right here on Chicago's Progressive Talk, AM and FM.
Good planets are hard to find. Temperate zones and tropic climes. True currents and thriving seas. Wind blowing through breathing trees. Strong ozone and safe sunshine. Well, good planets are hard to find. Good planets are in demand.
This hour of the Mike Novak Show is brought to you by Sid's Greenhouses, Chicagoland's premier garden centers, and by The Care of Trees. Our business is people and their love for trees. And by WRD Environmental, creating sustainable landscapes since 1997. Now here's the man who's greening your world one kilohertz at a time, Mike Novak.
Okay, I have just one question. Where was this weather when we needed it?
I know.
I mean, when you could actually do something about it. I'm looking at the stats that Rick DeMaio sent me. And, of course, he'll be here at 8:30 with the full forecast. And this week we should actually do the forecast instead of save it for the last 30 seconds.
That might be a good idea.
Last week we chatted about everything. Oh, let's talk about this. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about this other thing. And, okay, it's almost 9 o'clock. We got to get the weather in. Oh, my God.
Well, the nice thing is people usually talk about the weather to fill time. And you know what I mean? So we kind of did the polar opposite. We had so much to talk about. We're like, oh, yeah, and then there's weather, too.
It's always important if it's a weather segment. You got to get the weather forecast in.
But you know what? Think.
The way I feel, we drag those people along for a half hour. And we're listening, just waiting for a forecast. And by that time, it got to be 9 o'clock. And they said, I'll just turn on the TV. I can catch it there.
But without such whim and whimsy.
Well, anyway, Rick DeMaio, who will be on at 8:30 with the full forecast, I promise, sends this email this morning. He's up in Lake Geneva, so he's taking advantage of this. On the 8th day of November, I'm sure he's kayaking or something, or swimming in... You're looking good, by the way.
Thanks.
You know, last week it was Halloween.
Yep.
Heather Fry goes to a wedding last night, and I told her. I said, if you want to understand how this business works, Sunday is a work day, all right? Which means that Saturday's a prep day. No more parties, no social activity at all. You do not get, you work for me now. I own you.
I guess
right?
So, on the weekend.
You tell your friends that your former life is now over.
What life? I'm a mom.
I know. Well, you seem to be able to find time to go trick-or-treating and go to weddings and bar mitzvahs and brisses and everything you need.
No bris as of yet. I've never been to a bris.
Well, you will. It'll probably be next week. It's like every
all
week.
Right, invite me to your press.
Every week I get a text from her about 6 a.m. I'm alive. I'm coming in. Don't worry. I'll be there.
At least you know I'm on my way. That's the whole point.
Oh, yeah, like, but you could do that and just fall back asleep, too.
I could. In theory, I could. I could have this morning. I'm not hungover today, though. Last week, I was.
See, you're not supposed to say that out loud.
I'll admit it. But I was a good girl. I'm just tired. I was a very good girl because I had to come in and do the show.
For crying out loud.
You got to cut loose every now and then. Not every time, though. Last weekend, cut loose. This weekend, no.
Oh, dear. So back to the email from Rick DeMaio. Saturday's maximum temperature was 71 degrees. The highest November daily maximum temperature, no, okay, one day temperature is 81 degrees on November 1st, 1950. The highest November daily maximum temperature from November 7th through November 30th is 78 on November 14th, 1971. This is the 41st time a November day has reached or exceeded 71 degrees on November 7th through 30th. Only two December days reached 71 degrees in 138 years. We did not hit 70 degrees in October. This is only the third time that's happened. And Saturday was the warmest day since September 27th. And I'm happy. I haven't planted any of my bulbs yet, so and they're all sitting in bags.
Is that what you're going to do today?
Nah.
You're going to watch some football, aren't you?
No. I think I'm playing golf.
Good. That's good. It's a beautiful day for it.
It is. Mm-hmm. And everybody else is going to be watching the game, so I'm just going to tape the game.
I'm probably going to take the peanuts to the playground, I think, and be outside. I'll miss the football game.
Is that code for your son?
It's my son and my nephew together.
The peanuts.
Yeah, the peanuts.
All right. So I was right.
Yes, you were.
And then we have a hurricane. You know, it feels like it's September. We got hurricanes. We got 70-degree temperatures. Rick DeMaio writes, Ida reaches hurricane intensity. It's located in the northwestern Caribbean Sea, about 120 miles east-southeast of Cozumel, Mexico. Recently reported a one-minute sustained wind of 74 miles. Is that all it takes? A one-minute sustained wind of 74 miles per hour? I have to ask Rick.
Yeah, I don't know.
Let's see. Boop, 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 boop. So we'll find out where that's headed. And you say he's got new stuff up on his website?
On his website.
All right. So those of you who are, we'll actually give you your weather forecast today. We promise. Kind of fell down on that last week. But I'm moving this clock. I want to be able to see. What were they doing? What was Jake doing in here yesterday?
They had the only thing older than time that will probably survive nuclear holocaust and cockroaches. Joan Rivers was on. So they had a riveting show yesterday.
Oh, stop it. You make these comments.
I know.
And then I pay for them.
I know. Sorry.
Then I pay for them.
Oh, that was Jake's crew knows who that was directed at.
Oh, okay.
He knows.
Well, if you want to have a war with Jessica and Greg, go ahead.
Not Jessica, just Greg.
Just Greg.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
He says it coming, too.
Like I said, you know who will end up paying for this. Last night, while Heather was cavorting at a wedding, I was cavorting at the Sierra Club Illinois Chapter 50th Anniversary Celebration, which was just cool. It was at the Cook County Forest Preserve District Volunteer Resource Center on 6100 North Central in Chicago, and it's in the forest preserve there, so I drove by it at night. It's kind of hard to see. And then found it again. But I emceed the event. It was a lot of fun. One of the things that came out of this is the bullfrog sang, which was cool. And it's not literally bullfrogs, but the group, the bullfrogs, which is great. And we celebrated the 50th anniversary of the Sierra Club Illinois, and Jack Darren 20 years there was celebrated, and we had Allison Chin, Sierra Club president, National Sierra Club president, and great food, and a group called Red Horse and the Stoneflies. And don't you yawn on me there, Missy. I'm going to play some of their music this morning because they were playing at the event. And we will get to that in just a little bit. So I want to thank the folks at the Sierra Club Illinois chapter celebrating 50 years. And, of course, Sue Lannon, who dragged me into this, who's a good buddy of mine. It were just does so many good things for so many organizations. So that was a lot of fun. Today on the show, we're talking about invasives and invasive insects, invasive diseases, opportunistic kinds of pests that are wreaking havoc with our trees and other plants, but primarily trees. And as a matter of fact, in just a second, we'll be talking to Faith Campbell from the Nature Conservancy about that. And new regulations proposed by the USDA to help beat down some of these pests. Later in the program, Guy Sternberg, the man with the deepest voice in horticulture. He was on the program. I think he may have been my very first guest a year and a half ago when I started here at WCPT. He's at Star Hill Forest Arboretum in Petersburg, Illinois, and went down there to Springfield to talk to some folks, actually about food issues this week, and headed over to see Guy at Star Hill Forest Arboretum and see what he's been doing. And let me explain. It's not like he works at the Arboretum. He is the Arboretum. He and his wife, Edie, created an Arboretum from scratch 30 years ago. That's just amazing. And it's 40 acres, and they've won all kinds of awards. There's a new award that they're receiving, and I want to tell you about that. And, of course, all of this information is up on my website, mikenowak.net, MikeNowak.net. And I want you to go there and take a look at it. Click on to this week's show, because all the information is there. You can listen to the podcast. Now, Heather and I are putting those up each week, so you get the full show. If you miss it on the program, you can always click on. And finally, in the show today, a few weeks ago, we talked to Connie Spreen from the Experimental Station in the South Park of the city of Chicago, in Hyde Park Woodlawn, about the 61st Street Garden and how there was a danger of them losing it, and it looks like that's going to happen. But some folks want to get together next week and have a community meeting about what they can do about urban agriculture in the area, and we will talk to her about that, and it's basically a follow-up to that conversation that we had a few weeks ago. But right now, we go to line one and bring in Faith Campbell. Hello, Faith. You're on the Mike Novak Show. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike.
How are you?
Oh, I'm fine. How about you?
Good. And you're based in Arlington, Virginia.
That's right.
Is that where you are now or at home?
I'm at home, which is a few miles away.
Uh-huh. And you're the senior policy representative at the Nature Conservancy headquarters in Arlington, Virginia. And I got some information the other week about new regulations that are proposed by the U.S. Department of Agriculture to help stem the tide of non-native pests. Now, in this regard, we're basically talking about trees, aren't we, Faith?
Well, the kinds of pests that get in could attack any kind of plant, but the concern at the Nature Conservancy is trees and shrubs out in the woods primarily.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, most of these pests get started in cities or suburbs. Chicago recently went through the Asian longhorn beetle nightmare.
Yes.
And now you've got the emerald ash borer. And those are just two examples of the kinds of things that can get in to our country and kill a lot of trees.
Well, not only that, you may have heard me while you were on hold there talking about going down to Star Hill Forest Arboretum in Menard County in Illinois One of the things that Guy showed me down there was an American chestnut tree that he's growing. Now, it's not, it hasn't been there forever. He planted it. But it's the prettiest thing, and it goes, you know, grows straight and tall, and it was always prized for its wood. But we basically don't have any of them left in America because of diseases that came in the early part of the 20th century. And this is just an example of the kinds of things that can happen, isn't it?
Exactly. The chestnut blight, Dutch elm disease, again, something that would be a memory for people in Illinois. We've had these introductions, these diseases and pests introduced, you know, for 150 or 200 years, but more recently, as the volumes of imports have risen and have come from a greater variety of countries, the risk rises also when more things have been getting in.
Well, I understand why things might want to change as the information that came from Nature Conservancy to me points out, the rules really hadn't changed in a long, long time. What is the update going to do in terms of changing the importation of plant material?
Okay, yes, you're right. The rules hadn't changed in a fundamental way for decades. The Agriculture Department recognizes that too many things are getting in, and they recognize that one of the problems is they have been too slow to react to kind of partial information, scientific information that has not yet been fully evaluated. So they are now, the new rule will give them a greater flexibility so that when they see indications of a risk, of a threat from a certain kind of plant coming from a certain part of the world, Asia or Europe or whatever, they will be able to temporarily prohibit importation of those plants from those areas while they find the time and the staff to more fully evaluate the situation and decide whether imports can be allowed again under certain controlled conditions.
Well, that sounds actually like an application of the precautionary principle. The idea that when an activity raises threats of harm to the environment or human health, precautionary measures should be taken, even if cause and effect relationships are not fully established scientifically. I mean, it sounds like you're just being smart at that point, and I'm sure there are growers and there are exporters, importers who would raise a ruckus, but we have to protect the native plants that we have here. I mean, like the American chestnut, like the American elm, which have been so devastated in this country. Would you say it is kind of a precautionary principle at work here?
I would say it's sort of halfway to the precautionary principle.
Okay.
But yes, it's moving in that direction, and I agree with you that it's the smart thing to do because the evidence is there, it should be responded to, and as Chicagoans know, once something gets into the country, it's extremely difficult and painful and often just plain impossible to kill it off and to protect our plants from it. You need to keep them out and not rely on finding out after they're here and then trying to figure out something to do about
it. We're talking to Faith Campbell, Senior Policy Representative at the Nature Conservancy's headquarters in Arlington, Virginia. If you have a question about any of this, please call 773-838-WCPT, 773-838-9278. You can also... if you like, you can go to MikeNovak.net and see information about this. I know it's early. I'm not sure how many people call about pest problems at 8:20 on a Sunday. My question to you, Faith Campbell, would be, in a sense, haven't we already lost the battle? Isn't the horse out of the barn? Emerald ash borer is here. Gypsy moth is here. You said Asian longhorn beetle, and the nice thing about Asian longhorn beetle, it's slow and stupid, and yet it's really destructive. I had an arborist on the program a few weeks ago, Edith Macra from the Morton Arboretum, who said, you know, despite being slow and stupid, people in Massachusetts got caught off guard recently and lost a whole bunch of trees. And it seems amazing because that beetle is so prominent. But my point is there's so many destructive pests in the country already. How many more can there be out there for us?
Millions.
Oh, dear.
No, seriously. In the beetle family alone, there are probably hundreds of millions, hundreds of thousands of species, and then there are nobody knows how many disease organisms, pathogens like sudden oak death or something like that. No, we have let too many in. There's no doubt about that. There are close to 400 at least exotic organisms that attack trees in North America now, but there are certainly many thousands more that could come here and kill a variety of trees that have so far not been attacked, or, you know, a second wave attacking things that have already had some damage but managed to get through that. So it's certainly worth the effort to prevent new introductions. That isn't the only thing, of course. We still need to respond to the ones we have. But as someone who works on aquatic invasives put it, if your house is filling up with water, the first thing you should do is shut the windows. And this new rule that APHIS is now working on, that USDA is now working on, will shut the windows considerably tighter than they have been so far.
You mentioned APHIS. You might want to explain for our listeners what APHIS is.
Sure. APHIS is the Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, and it is the part of the Department of Agriculture that's responsible for keeping out pests and for responding to them when they get in.
And we actually have a question here, Faith. You know, some people are awake at this hour in the morning. Let's go to June in Lockport. Hi, June. You're in the Mike Novak Show.
Good morning. I have a chestnut tree in the front of my house, which I don't know if it's an American chestnut or not, but they came in. The power people just chopped it up, and I told them I didn't want them to, and they argued with me, whatever. But now I'm concerned that it's more vulnerable to be, have a problem with some type of bug. So I was wondering where I can go and find out about how I can protect this tree in any way, and if it's on any endangered list or anything like that, since you were mentioning the chestnut tree earlier.
Well,
that's why one of the reasons we bought the house, because it had this beautiful chestnut tree in front of it.
Now, the important thing here is identification, wouldn't you say, Faith?
Yes. I would think that if it's a large, healthy tree, it is probably not an American chestnut.
That's what I was thinking, too. It could be another kind of chestnut, but the first thing you should do, June, is have the tree ID'd. And then, in order to continue to protect it, June, Faith, what would you suggest?
Okay, well, now we're getting beyond where I'm an expert. But the,
all right.
I think you should probably have an arborist go look at it and see whether there are any kinds of insect attacks or something like that that could be worse at those areas where the branches were cut off. That could provide an opening for that.
And that's exactly what I was going to say, June. You know, the Care of Trees is an advertiser on my show, and they're great people, and they'll come out and look at your tree. And
how do you get a hold of these people? Are they on your website? Or
they are on my website, and okay. As a matter of fact, I can give you their information right now, which is thecareoftrees.com.
Okay.
Or you can call them at 847-394-4220. Now, one of the things...
TheCareOfTrees.com. Okay.
TheCareOfTrees.com. And one of the things they can do, and I think it's really important that you brought this up about a chestnut. Folks buy properties, and they see a beautiful tree on it. And the tree, you know, if it's healthy and growing and beautiful, that is something in itself. It is a good in itself. And yet they might not know what the exact species is. And this is a good reason to bring out an arborist. So you can determine exactly what you have. And once you know exactly what you have, and, of course, a large, mature tree is very valuable, so you want to be able to protect it. As Faith said, I doubt that it's an American chestnut, but it's some other kind of chestnut, and you should know what you have so that you can proceed accordingly. And if you call an arborist, and the Care of Trees is not the only arborists out there, but they're a good company, and there are other very good, reputable companies. If you have friends that suggest something, I mean, I suggest the Care of Trees, but they'll come out, and they can look at it, they can ID it for you, they can give you a sense of whether it's in danger, And often they do that for free. To just give you some advice. Of course, they want your business, but that's one of the reasons, or one of the ways they get it. So that's what I would suggest next, June.
Okay, and is there, are there people who, you know, these places who cultivate trees, do they cultivate this American chestnut that you could have one planted at your home?
Do you want to address that, Faith? Because,
sure.
Go ahead.
The American Chestnut Foundation and others have spent decades trying to breed chestnuts, American chestnuts, that are immune to the blight that came in 100 years ago. And the American Chestnut Foundation is now testing its young trees. It's had people plant them out on their property, and there's some on national forest land in the southeast and that kind of thing. So they're still testing to see how well it is thriving in the presence of the disease, because the disease is here forever. We're never going to get rid of that. So right now, I doubt that there are American chestnuts ready for you to buy, but in another several years, there might well be.
Super.
Yeah,
we have to wait now.
Yeah, you do. There are still mature specimens of American chestnuts around, and believe me, they are watched very carefully.
Okay.
And most of those trees are outside of the natural range of the American chestnut, which is kind of, if you look on a map, sort of follows the Appalachians. I was just reading the other day, Faith, about this. At one point, we had 4 billion. American chestnuts, and we're probably down to, in the range, 100 or so that are mature. Yeah. Outside of the range, it's also harder for the disease to survive. So that's why some of those trees still exist in Michigan, in Wisconsin, and some other places. But that's not really the natural range of the tree. So it's kind of, it's sad, and this is why we're talking about this subject. June, thank you so much for calling.
And keep up the good work with your show. I appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate you listening. Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to the Mike Novak Show on Chicago's Progressive Talk, AM and FM, talking to Faith Campbell from the Nature Conservancy about new rules by the USDA. And you worked with them and other organizations. What other organizations were involved in this, Faith?
Well, we have a loose coalition called the Continental Dialogue on Non-Native Forest Insects and Diseases, which involves the American Nursery and Landscape Association, the National Association of State Foresters, the National Plant Board, which is the state departments of agriculture all grouped together, and several wood products companies, and lots of others who are working on a variety of ways of improving protection for the nation's trees from these exotic pests. And all of those organizations have communicated to the Department of Agriculture, both in meetings and now in our formal comments on this proposed rule, our support for their moving to this new, more flexible approach. In fact, I've been through all the comments. The comment period closed couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, that was something I was going to mention, is that when I first got the information, the comment period was still open, but it has closed. Since it has, what can the average person do to influence the USDA, or can it not be influenced at this point?
Well, while it would not be part of the comment period, I think communications to the Secretary of Agriculture about the importance of this would still be useful. Letting your members of Congress know that you think this is something important to do, that would be very useful, because, of course, they have oversight over the department, and some of them, they also fund the department's activities. At this point, our concern, or our immediate focus, is to ensure that this rule change not get lost. You know, they've had the proposal in the comments, now they have to finalize the change. And we want that to happen in as brief a period as possible, maybe 8 months, 6 months, something like that, because everything has taken a long time to get this far. We don't want it to slide back into low priority. Everybody's
right.
got a lot to do, and other things might take precedence.
And the idea, again, is that you would have a little more flexibility. You'd be nimbler in your response. If you spot something, if enough people say, hey, this is a problem, scientists, arborists, other, you know, biologists, that you can get the word out and slow down or stop the importation of a certain plant until it's determined that whether there is a pest problem associated with that. Would you say that, in a nutshell, is kind of what we're talking about?
Yes, it is.
All right. Well, I hope that happens. If you want more information, you can go to my website, Mike Novak. Not you, Faith, but other people can go to my website, MikeNovak.net. I've got the information up there this week on the Mike Novak Show. I have a link to the Nature Conservancy and some information about emerald ash borer and the chestnut tree we were talking about. Faith Campbell from Nature Conservancy, thank you so much, and good luck. Keep us posted.
Okay, thank you.
Take care now.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to Chicago's Progressive Talk, AM and FM. It is a Sunday morning. It is 8:33. It's about the time we go to line, actually 8:34, but who's counting? Rick DeMaio is on line two. You know me. I can't keep anything on time on this show.
Yeah, well, good thing you're on radio and not TV, right?
Yeah, we've talked about that before. Yeah, you gotta be right down to the second on that stuff. They got people holding up time cues and stuff like that and waving their arms at you.
Yeah, 5 seconds means 5 seconds.
Actually, 5 seconds usually means, like, you know, what I'm always amazed at, mm-hmm. not so much on local television, mm-hmm. but on national television and national radio. When people bring in a caller and they know they've got 15 seconds and they're trying to squeeze in a caller in 15 seconds, and I feel sorry for the callers because they're always going, hi, love your program.
Yeah, right.
And, oh, sorry, your 15 seconds are up. You know, by the time they get that out, they're done. And,
yeah.
You know, and when I sit here and, you know, people who are not in the biz, they might not want to know anything about it, but if I'm sitting here and I got 2 minutes left, I know I can just vamp for 2 minutes if I have to. But if I bring in a caller, they're going to ask something that I've never heard before, and now I'm going to start scrambling trying to find an answer, and then I'm going to run out of time. But hey, or like last week when you and I talked, and we talked for a half an hour, and then we did the last 20 seconds, the forecast, because we forgot to do that.
Well, I think people kind of knew what was happening anyway, just by the fact that we were not talking about the weather.
Well, yeah, we were talking about Halloween.
That's kind of like today, right?
So far. I want to play one thing for you, though, before I promised, and I hope they're listening in. This is Red Horse and the Stone Flies, and I wanted to do as kind of an intro to your segment. Give me just a second here, Rick, and it goes something like this.
Sin with his eyes down low. Ain't no need of somebody, let him go. I got the big head blues. I got the Asian car blues. I said, whoa, no, I got the big head
blues. I got the big head Asian carp blues. Now, isn't that cool? This is a group called Red Horse and the Stone Flies, and all profits from the sale of this CD go to local environmental groups who have contributed to preserving and protecting the globally significant resources of the Chicago region. And they were playing last night at the Sierra Club Illinois Chapter 50th Anniversary Celebration, and I told them, you know what? I like your stuff. I'm going to play it on the show today. And and it's really kind of bluesy and a little bit of country in there.
Calm down.
And yeah. So
I will
play some more of that. And since the money's going to a good cause, if you're interested, did we find a site, Heather?
We found, they had a MySpace page I found where you can email and request copies of the CD.
I'll tell you what I'll do. To make it easy, because it's I don't have that email address up on my website. If you write to me, MikeNovak.net, Mike@MikeNovak.net, I will send you the forward so where you can get this CD. And it's $10. I mean, you can't go wrong. It's a lot of fun. I'll play some more of it later. What's the temperature right now, Rick DeMille? Do you have any idea?
Yeah, 53 at O'Hare and 53 at Midway. Normal high for this time of year, Mike, is 52 degrees. So not bad that we've reached our normal high already at 8 in the morning. You know that there's something up with the weather, right, when that happens?
Well, that's what I want to know. As I told Heather earlier, where was this when we needed it?
Well, you know, better late than never, right?
I guess, because I'm going to go out and play today.
Oh, yeah.
The problem is you...
You got to do it before, I know you're going to say before like 4:30, right?
Yeah, because it gets dark.
Oh, God.
Well, yeah, it does. I mean, it's kind of a practical consideration. Why, is something happening at 4:30?
No, I'm just saying that's when it begins to get dark. 4:30, sunset is at like 4:48 right now. And,
yeah.
My son and I are up here at Lake Geneva right now at the Abbey, and we were out riding our bikes yesterday around the lake, and all of a sudden I'm like, we got to get going because it's going to get dark in about an hour, and it's 3:30 already, and you're thinking to yourself, man, where did the day go? So, yeah, this is definitely the time of the year that when you have a present, you got to enjoy it in a hurry because otherwise it's gone.
It doesn't seem fair that you get a nice day and it's over by 4:30, so... What's causing this and how long is it going to happen?
Well, actually, there's a couple of things, Mike. This was due to a huge deep trough that developed across the western half of the United States. This was part of the same system that brought all the heavy snow out to Colorado and the northern Rockies. And the trough has basically moved westward and allowed us to have, you know, strong southwesterly flow. So over the last couple of days, we've tapped into some very dry air. Really, the only way you can get really warm this time of the year is with 100% sunshine, and that's what we had yesterday. Milwaukee, Wisconsin set a record. They hit 71. Madison, Wisconsin hit 71. They hit a record. Record for O'Hare yesterday was 74. We didn't break it, but we did hit 71. Oddly enough, Mike, we went through the entire month of October without a 70-degree day. And that's amazing, and yet we hit 70 in November, and that's only the third time we ever went the entire month of October in Chicago without hitting 70. And then we hit it on, you know, the first weekend, so the timing was nice, and we had sunshine. And actually, the winds actually, you know, lightened up yesterday. So typically you get a real windy southwest flow when you get warm, but the fact that the winds lightened up yesterday allowed people to enjoy it. You know, you don't sometimes have, you know, all those factors working together at the same time. The second reason is we now have Hurricane Ida, which is just off the coast of the Yucatan, and that's beginning to push northward. And as hurricanes move north in the Gulf of Mexico, they tend to warm up the middle parts of the atmosphere. And what they do, they don't really bring warm air into the Midwest, but they typically tend to keep the jet stream further north across the northern plains. And if they do so, and I think this one is actually having somewhat of an influence, but not as much, but it tends to block the cold air coming in from Canada and the northern plains states. So the front that was expected to drive southward through Illinois today, while we did have a bit of a wind shift, we're not going to have a strong wind shift. So bottom line, wind will be off the lake today at about maybe 3 to about 5 miles per hour. Lake water temperature right now is about 50. So instead of having temperatures in the low 70s, which we had yesterday, we'll call it maybe mid to upper 60s today, which is still nice. It's still very nice. But this hurricane, which, believe it or not, looks like it's going to make a run at New Orleans as a Category 1 during the day on Monday. And while it's not going to be one where they have to evacuate, but all of a sudden they're like, wait a minute, it's November. Aren't we done with hurricanes now? Well, typically the Gulf of Mexico around the Straits of Yucatan, late October, early November is when they tend to get these 1 to 2 or 3 day hurricanes that develop in waters where the temperature is still right around 81 or 82 degrees. And if they get a little bit of a nudge northward, they'll come onshore as a Category 1. So So a little bit of a couple of things producing a nice weather both today and even tomorrow, I think, as well, Mike.
That's fabulous. Now, is this any way, I mean, not fabulous, the hurricane hitting New Orleans, I mean, blacking.
I know you, Mike.
Is this an indication of things to come for the winter, or is this an, are we going to get, does this, any of what we're getting today have anything to do with El Nino?
You know what, there's a couple of different ways you can look at it. El Nino still is somewhat weak on a scale of 1 to 10, with 1 being weak and 10 being strong. I would put it right now as a 4.5 to a 5. I think the jet stream pattern that's developing across the Pacific Ocean has some influences of El Nino with it. But the problem for Chicago, Illinois, the Midwest, is we're usually at the eastern edge of the influences of weak El Ninos. Strong El Ninos, basically everybody from coast to coast is influenced by it. Obviously off the west coast of California, or I say the west coast of the U.S., meaning California, and into the desert southwest. My feeling is with weak to moderate El Ninos, if you have enough cold air across northern sections, I should say southeastern sections of Canada, the northeastern part of the United States, typically that cold air merging with some of these weak storm systems that come through the southern plains can sometimes bear quite a bit of snow. So I'm still thinking that we're going to have somewhat of a snowy winter, meaning that it's going to be more of a wet, heavy snow, particularly the first part of winter and the second part. But it all depends on how El Nino transitions. Does it transition back to a weak event? Does it transition to a stronger event? If it goes weak to strong, then most likely we'll probably end up having a mild winter and temperatures maybe in the 50s a couple of times, even in December and January. I don't see that happening. I see this as a weak El Nino and staying weak. And thus, in past winters in Chicago, weak El Ninos can sometimes bring quite a bit of snow. But the one thing we do see is that we're not going to have as much Arctic outbreaks, or I should say as many Arctic outbreaks that we've had over the last couple of years. So to kind of put your question into a one-sentence answer, I don't think what we see now is what we're going to have the rest of the winter. What I see is most likely near-seasonable temperatures, but probably still above-average snowfall due to the fact that we'll have a lot more storm systems coming through. The good thing, though, I don't think we're going to have as much cold weather. But again, as I mentioned, at every time I get a long-range forecast means long-range analysis as well. So as you're going through the process, you have to make sure that the process is working out to what you're saying and not saying, well, remember what I told you back in October? You can't do that in long-range forecast.
So I should be playing the tap dancing sound effect right now? Is that it?
That's exactly what I wanted you to say to that.
I so misuse you, don't I?
Yeah, that's okay. I've been humbled before, and you're not the first.
Oh, I like you, Rick, and I understand that there's no real certainty. Oh my goodness, I can't imagine trying to be a meteorologist and even tell people what's going to happen tomorrow, let alone in December or January or through the whole winter.
Well, the thing about being a meteorologist is you first have to learn the science, and then you have to learn how to present the science. And if you learn how to present the science, then you're doing a pretty good job. If all you do is learn the science and don't know how to present it, then you're not really learning the field. And I always say it's like TV. If you never think you're going to be fired or let go of a station, you're pretty naive. If you go through the field of meteorology, feel like you can never be humbled, you're pretty naive as well.
Believe me, I work in radio. I know what it's like to be humble.
You know,
radio and TV, it's just some people call them revolving doors, and they kind of are at points.
Yeah, without a doubt.
So this week, what are we looking for?
Okay, bottom line is temperatures today probably about 5 to 6 degrees cooler than they were yesterday, particularly along the lakefront. As I mentioned, the front is south of us, so we're looking for a high of about 62 North Shore, about 65 downtown, about 68 far south, but a lot more high thin clouds today than we had yesterday. So nice factor of 10. Few clouds tonight, low of 45. Tomorrow, I think a pretty nice day. We'll call it sunshine, mixture of some clouds as well. Probably still upper 50s to near 60 North Shore tomorrow, upper 60s far south. And then some clouds and maybe a little bit of a sprinkle on Tuesday, but I doubt it. I think mainly dry weather for Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. And all three of those days, temperature is probably in the mid-50s to about 60. But it all depends on still what Hurricane Ida does, because they're talking about the possibility of the storm kind of merging with the big high pressure system over the northern Great Lakes. If that happens, we'll have a much stronger northeast wind on Wednesday. But nonetheless, I think the short-term concern is, you know, whether or not this is going to have a flooding problem or a flooding influence on the Gulf Coast meeting New Orleans. But bottom line, Mike, is nothing real wet and nothing real cold in Chicago for the next 7 days. So excellent weather continues for what appears to be still a rather late harvest for a lot of the Illinois and Wisconsin farmers.
I got to tell you, I went down to Springfield earlier this week for a couple of days of meetings, and driving down and back, saw the farmers out there on, you know, Wednesday and Thursday because they were dry.
Right.
And you know they were hitting those fields just to get that stuff done, because we talked about that last week. And, and even at night, they get the headlights on.
Exactly. Yeah. I was just about to mention that. I was coming back from Lake Geneva last night. It was about 5:30. It wasn't too dark out yet. But yeah, the combines had their lights on trying to get the soybeans in. So they're working probably 12 hours a day this time of the year.
I'm wondering how long do they go at night? You know, when do they knock off? They knock off at 8 p.m., 9 p.m., 10?
Oh, no, I don't think they go that late.
Not that late, because I figure they got to be up early with the.
Right.
But, you know, if you're that far behind, you know, how much sleep are you getting really? Is what I was wondering.
But last night, oddly enough, we had a really bright sunset. So our civil twilight, which is normally about 30 minutes this time of the year, may have been stretched about another 10 minutes last night. So the sky was actually bright up until about, I think about 5:30. And what I noticed about the fields, notice how all the corn has gone from green to kind of like brownish orange, almost like a pasty white yellow. Have you noticed that?
Yeah, I did notice them.
Yeah, there's absolutely no moisture left in them. So on certain nights where you have clear skies, the field almost has a certain brightness to it, almost a certain amount of illumination.
Yeah.
So and it's almost like having snow on the ground. If you ever walk through a snow field at sunset, you walk into the field, you go, oh, my gosh, I could read a book in the sunset a half hour ago.
Right.
So I think that extra brightness has kind of helped out as well. But I think they normally go about an hour after sunset. And, you know, they got a lot of work to do between, you know, servicing the equipment and getting a good night's sleep and getting back out there tomorrow morning. But the bottom line is, Mike, between now and next Saturday, generally pretty decent weather.
Can you take one quick call before I let you go?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, let's go to Bruce. You went on I-355, is that it?
Yes, I am. I'm coming back from southwestern Michigan for the weekend. One of the things I've noticed here, while the weather is quite mild, there seems to be a great deal of haze in the air.
Haze.
I mean, almost a smoggy type of effect. Do we have a situation where the air on the ground is warm but not too far up? It's pretty cold, or what's going on?
Bruce, actually, that's the opposite. We actually have a lot of farmers and a lot of local municipalities burning leaves. And because we have what's called a temperature inversion, meaning cooler at the surface and warmer above, because the temperature probably about a few, maybe 500 to 1,000 feet above the surface is already about 60 degrees. So with that cooler weather at the surface, you create somewhat of a mini high pressure system. So cool air molecules not moving as fast, the air is more dense. And I noticed this even up here in southern Wisconsin yesterday. There was all this haze and fog and smoke from a lot of people burning their leaves. So it's probably a combination of leaf burning and also a lot of the dust that's being dug up from the soil, from the field, as well as the breakdown of the material, the soybeans or the plant material. So you're probably getting a lot of stuff there, Bruce. If you have any allergy problems, this is probably not the best air to breathe.
Mike, you know, I noticed it this morning. I started to hack, and it was just amazing. You know, there was an irritant in the air that I had difficulty managing for a while.
Right, and I feel the same way, because if all of a sudden my body is breathing in, or my lungs are breathing in air that it's not used to, I'm like, whoa, what's going on? And I felt that. I had to run my air conditioner in my car yesterday only because of all the combination of the smoke and some of the crop dust that was kind of getting mixed up. So, yeah, good observation on your part, Bruce, without a doubt.
Great, Bruce. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it.
Okay, bye.
So I would guess, Rick, that... Sorry, I didn't hang up on him. Yeah, can I? Wait. There we go.
No, now you just hung up on Rick.
Did I just? Oh,
you hung up on Rick.
That was the other. That was the problem.
Yeah.
Ah!
I was trying, but you.
All right, I had one more question for Rick. Get him back, and while I do this, all right. I'm sorry, Rick. I forgot he was on line two, not line one. Ah, speaking of everything, here's a tip from the Care of Trees. With the economy still shaky, if you're just about to buy a house, you don't want the trees on the property to cost you an extra couple of $1,000s, which means that you want to know how healthy the trees are on your new property. Just as a home might have defects invisible to the untrained eye, trees often have hidden defects that can make them hazardous or costly to maintain. If a tree is structurally unsound, you may need to remove it, which can turn your bargain into a boondoggle. Determining potential problems up front can help you negotiate the purchasing price of your home and budget for future maintenance needs. That's why you should make the Care of Trees your permanent partner in enhancing the value of your landscape. Whether you want to make sure all is well with the trees in your yard, you're changing your landscaping, or you're moving, invite the certified arborist at the Care of Trees to take a look. Like I told the woman earlier on the show, you know, you got a problem, you're wondering if it's a chestnut or it's something else, they can also ID it for you. Call the Care of Trees at 847-394-4220. The Care of Trees, their businesses, people, and their love for trees. Back to Rick DeMille. Sorry about that, Rick.
Oh, that's okay.
but you brought it up, or Bruce did, actually, which is the burning of leaves. And Heather mentioned this last week, and she said, you know, is it harmful, burning your leaves? Well, you know, it's banned in a lot of places, mostly urban areas. And I turned it around on her, and I said, well, you know, the way I look at it, let's not look at the negatives of burning. Let's look at the positives of using your leaves as mulch and compost. However, since I have you on the phone and you are an environmentalist, how much effect do you think burning leaves has on our air?
I think it all kind of depends on. It seems to be more of a local effect. I know up here in Walworth County, I think some of the property owners have too much leaves. I mean, you can only use so much for compost,
sure.
And I know they have to get rid of them. Now, I don't know how much they actually burn. I know that I was driving through the area, and everybody had their leaves on the side of the road, which means obviously the county trucks are going to be picking them up. Now, what the county trucks do with them, I don't know. I don't know if they actually burn them. I would doubt the county does. Because that would obviously probably produce some sort of an environmental issue. I would think they probably mulch them and grate them and put them into compost and other parts of the surrounding area, particularly your parks and landscape areas. But, you know, I'm not sure about that. I really don't know. Although from a standpoint of what Bruce said, I think on certain days, I know out in California, Mike, they have certain laws on you can't burn firewood in your fireplace when they have these strong temperature inversions in the Sacramento Valley, because everybody is burning their wood, and then you get these inversions where you have this enormous amount of smoke, because that climate out there renders these inversions sometimes last for 2 or 3 weeks. I think in an environment where you have a lot of mixture and a lot of, I should say, mixing of the air and the atmosphere, I don't think it probably presents that much of a problem. So I think it's a much more of a local effect.
Well, you know what?
They deal with local issues.
They actually have that in Washington State as well, especially in the Seattle area, because a lot of those homes, because of the wood out there, have fireplaces.
Right.
And they have to ban it at certain times of the year, especially, I would assume, if they have a temperature inversion.
Exactly. And that's the real thing. I think you have to deal with these things on a case-by-case basis. And region by region.
Well, I was just kind of wondering, because people ask about it, and, you know, I thought, you know, and you're right, in the scheme of things, it may not contribute that much to anything in the atmosphere. I mean, but there's particulate matter that goes up, obviously, the carbon dioxide released.
Right.
But as you said, it's probably more of an effect locally, and I can understand why municipalities might have to ban stuff. All right, well, listen, I should have let you go long ago, but thank you so much.
Okay.
Rick DeMille Weather, you can catch him every week at 8:30 on the program, and he's updated his website, new stuff up on there. You can link to DeMilleWeather.com through my website, MikeNovak.net, or just go to DeMilleWeather.com. Rick, we'll talk to you next week.
Okay, have a good week, Mike and Heather.
Bye-bye. Like it or not, the holiday season is upon us. Really? It is. And Sid's Greenhouses invites you to attend their annual Christmas open house starting Saturday, November 14th through the 21st with a special preview night this Friday from 5 to 8 p.m. at their stores in Palos Hills and Bolingbrook. There's lots planned for this week-long celebration, including tasty holiday refreshments, free pictures with Santa. I can't believe we're talking about Santa already. Here we're the 8th of November. What you gonna do? But you know, you gotta get ready if you're a business, right? And there's door prizes, and perhaps best of all, up to 60% off Christmas decor to help make your holiday celebrations extra special. SIDS has the most extensive selection of Christmas and holiday decor in Chicagoland, like, for instance, over 100 styles of lifelike artificial trees in sizes up to 12 feet. They have dozens of themed decorated trees loaded with thousands of unique collectible ornaments to choose from. They have beautiful wreaths, garlands, and Christmas arrangements to decorate your home or office, and it's all up to 60% off during SID's Holiday Preview Open House starting this Friday at 5 p.m. Visit SIDSonline.com for all the details and to download a coupon for $10 off your purchase. SIDS, Chicagoland's premier garden centers, nursery, and florist are located in Palos Hills on Southwest Highway and in Bolingbrook on Napier Plainfield Road at Hassert Boulevard.
All right, there in those fields, couldn't believe my eyes. He was straight and tall and lean and gold, know it by his name. It'll be gone in a year or two, and the country never be the same. There's corn in DuPage County.
There you go. We're running out of time this hour. We've got some more tree stuff we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about community gardens in Chicago, and that's all coming up after the news, CNN News, at 9 o'clock.
You're listening to WCPT's Self-Help Sundays. 4 hours of home improvement help for inside and outside your home.
820 WCPT AM Willow Spring. 92.7 WCPT FM Arlington Heights. 92.5 FM WCPY DeKalb. And 99.9 FM WCPQ Park Forest.
Self-Help Sundays on WCPT AM and FM, Chicago's Progressive Talk.
Hey, welcome back. It's hour two of the Mike Novak Show, Chicago's only locally broadcast green gardening and environment program.
This hour of the Mike Novak Show is brought to you by SIDS Greenhouses, Chicagoland's premier garden centers, and by The Care of Trees, our business's people and their love for trees, and by WRD Environmental, creating sustainable landscapes since 1997. Here he is, once again, Mike Novak.
It's filled with paint, wilt you on real slow. Sand and grease makes this landscape glow. This place is nothing you could dream. All of the clouds are never made of steam. Everyone here builds with brick and beam. This place will never be clean.
There they are, Red Horse and the Stoneflies. On the Mike Novak Show, Chicago's Progressive Talk, AM and FM. As I mentioned, they performed last night at the big event, the Sierra Club Illinois Chapter 50th Anniversary Celebration. And now the information's up on my website at MikeNovak.net, MikeNowak. Thanks, Kathleen, for posting that. Although Red Horse is one word, R-E-D. H-O-R-S-E, the H is not capitalized. Anyway, but the information is up on how to get a copy of Red Horse and the Stoneflies CD And the best thing about it is all profits from the sale of the CD go to local environmental groups who are protecting the Chicago region, so that's a cool thing. Here we are in the second half of the first part of Soft Serve Sunday. Self-deprecation Sunday? What is it?
Self-help Sunday.
Oh, right. Yeah. Sad Sack Sunday? I can never remember the name.
I think I have fallen into the sad sack category today.
You are the sad sack category.
That's okay.
At 10 o'clock, of course, Ron Cowgill, Joe Builder, the Mighty House team will be here to answer your home improvement questions. Have you seen them? I'm not even sure they're around.
I have not seen them about yet, no.
They're quiet this morning. Maybe they were at a wedding last night, too.
Maybe. They weren't at the same one I was, but there were three in there. There were three in that banquet hall. And
three people? That's
it? No, three weddings. And so you could see the really inebriated folks getting confused and going into the wrong reception. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of funny to watch.
And before we get to Guy Sternberg from Starhill Forest Arboretum, I got an email last week from my buddy, Don Choi. He says, just to keep you on your toes, I understand you were rushing your info on the radio. Aren't we always? Why does it always seem to be the last 30 seconds of a segment?
Is he referring to the weather? Because I was the only one that was really rushed last
week.
No,
he was referring to the spider plant thing when we gave away. We were trying to, you know, tell people what a bamboo, lucky bamboo was. That it wasn't really a bamboo, it's a Dracaena. And then we had people who called and they said, I said, what's the real name? And they said, well, Lily. Well,
it's a member of the Lily family.
Member of the Lily family. It's really a Dracaena is what I was looking for. And then I'm somehow spider plant got involved because the spider plant is a member of the Lily family, but the spider plant is not a Dracaena. And for those of you who just don't care, but there are people who care, because I know that that Guy Sternberg online cares, because he's got a lot of houseplants in his place. And Don Choi cares, because at the Lincoln Park Conservatory, he is Captain Coleus, and I know he cares. So he wrote me, and he said, the spider plant is not a Dracaena. You were trying to say it was part of the Lily family. Just to be picky again, he writes, I don't think the White House grew the sweet potatoes from seed. Love ya, Don. Love you too, Don. Did we say they planted the sweet potatoes from seeds?
I don't know.
I was reading an article, and it wasn't the one I had found.
We found several.
You found one, and so I was going through it quickly, and it may have said they grew them from seeds. I don't believe they grew them from seeds either.
Grow the majority of the crop from seeds?
Well, some of them would have lettuces and that sort of thing. That's seed stuff. You know, so there's some things that are easy to grow from seed and other things not so much, like a sweet potato. So, I have no idea. If we said they grew the sweet potatoes from seeds, mea culpa, mea maxima culpa. If I didn't, why are you writing me, Don? I love you, Don. Thanks. But that's what I like about my listeners. I got people that run the gamut. They keep me on my toes, you know, from the people who have no idea what a lucky bamboo is to people who are working in the Lincoln Park Conservatory who start jotting this stuff down. Ooh, Mike made a mistake. Ooh, okay. And he does that, Dan Costa, my buddy, out at Vern Goer's greenhouses in Hinsdale. He does that to me and a few other people who will... They're not afraid to write, and I like it. I want to stand corrected. I don't want to give out misinformation. Lord knows I do enough of that. So let us go to line two and bring in the man with the deepest voice in horticulture, Guy Sternberg. How are you, Guy?
Hey, good morning, Mike. How you doing?
You were kidding.
Yeah, no, I'm not kidding. You did that on purpose, didn't you, Guy?
Well, it's always nice to be on air with the poet laureate of Chicagoland gardening.
The poet laureate. You've been reading my column from the November-December issue, haven't you?
Every chance I get.
I dropped one of those off. Guy, I visited Guy down in Petersburg, Illinois, this week, where Guy has an arboretum. And if you go to my website, you have the link to it. It's not every person in the world who starts their own arboretum. It's a remarkable achievement, Guy. And I know you've been working hard at it for about 30 years. But fabulous stuff, and you've just gotten yourself... Okay, I want to get to your awards and stuff, but Bernie is the most patient man in the world. Bernie, are you still with us?
Yeah, I'm still with you. You know, they had a public service thing on TV. It's been running in the Indiana area about not removing trees to burn them where they're at. In other words, when you go in the forest and that, so you don't transfer the beetle. And I've been thinking about that. Then you had the program on today. But what about these tree services that cut down wood, number one, tree down, and then they turn around and sell the wood for firewood? Is anybody regulating that? I was just thinking.
That, you know, that's a really good point. How do you regulate people who do that kind of thing? Guy, you've been associated with... worked on trees. Are you a certified arborist yourself?
Yes, I am.
Of course. So tell Bernie about certification and what that means in a state.
Well, years ago, the state of Illinois had a tree expert licensing act where you would have to pass tests and be licensed like a roofer or an attorney or whatever. They dropped that, and now the International Society of Arboriculture, excuse me, has a certification process where arborists who are serious about their work will study, take an exam, and become certified. And they have to have 10 hours of continuing education every year, or 30 hours every 3 years, to be recertified. So if you find one who is a certified arborist, you know that they generally know what they're doing. And that being said, of course, arborists have specialties. You don't go to a foot doctor for brain surgery and so on. So you pick an arborist who has experience and is proficient in the types of tree work you want. But back to the firewood question, I believe most of the problems with moving emerald ash borer are not arborists, unless they're some of the fly-by-night guys. There are people who have a vacation home, say, in Michigan, and they go up there and cut down a ash tree and bring the wood home for them to take camping or in their own fireplace. And they stack the wood in the backyard, and out come the borers. In general, arborists work on a local level. The trees that they cut in your community are either chipped or cut for firewood or whatever in that community and sold locally. So I don't think that's as much of a concern as John Q. homeowner who doesn't realize what he's doing and goes out there and brings firewood back from other areas, you know, across county lines, across state lines, from quarantine areas out. And that's our huge problem right now.
As a rule, go ahead, Bernie.
Yeah, but in other words, what you're saying is just like here, we bought a this driver sold us some wood from Esplende. You know, they're big in removing trees around for ComEdison and that. And, you know, I mean, he was taking it to the dump, and he made a few extra bucks by dumping it for us for burn. And I just am wondering, it just seems like there's no control.
You know, it makes me, what was it? He said he, where did the wood come from, Bernie?
Esplende.
Esplende.
They got those ones trucks they cut down the trees for Commonwealth Edison. Trimming.
Okay, you were saying, Guy?
I say Esplende is one of the tree care companies that does work for utility companies.
All right, now, if they're working for utility companies, I assume they're certified. They know what they're doing, but Bernie's raised a really good point that if you don't know where the wood's coming from, for goodness sake, don't take it.
No, definitely. Don't bring it home yourself.
Hold on, Bernie, hold on a second. I'll get to you in a second. What was that, Guy?
Well, I say don't bring it home yourself from other areas, or don't take your dead trees to grandma's house down in Missouri or something for firewood. You know, the pests that are local, for example, in emerald ash borer, are already established in some areas. Let's keep them there until we can find ways to deal with them. And just don't move gypsy moth and emerald ash borer and Asian longhorn beetle and these pests around by moving firewood.
Yeah, and that's part of the problem. Folks they'll go camping and they'll use some wood that's there for fire, and then they throw some extra pieces in the back of the truck, and suddenly they're transporting emerald ash borer or gypsy moth. Bernie, what were you going to say?
Well, I have somebody down the street here in rural LaPorte County here that they have a tree service, and they sell wood and I really, you know, what we're all saying is that there's just no control over it. You can't have the individual person thinking about that. It's got to be the people that are doing the tree cutting.
Well, what are the protections, Guy, that a tree company has if they're going to be cutting wood? What sort of steps do they take to ensure that they're not transporting these pests?
Well, the biggest step, of course, is education. And if they are educated and if they're up on their trade, they will be certified, or at least the company's owner or one of their people will be certified. Regulatory speaking, the Department of Agriculture is in charge of monitoring these pests and trying to deal with it. They only have so many people, and they can't possibly cover everything. But if you do transport wood that is quarantined, for example, again, ash wood from beetle-infested areas to other areas, and they catch you, you know, it's a regulatory issue. It's, a criminal issue.
So if, let's say you're a guy like Bernie, and you're worried that the guy down the block is got wood that might be contaminated. What do you do? Can you rat on them? Can you bust these people?
Well, definitely you can call the Department of Agriculture and ask them, you know, inform them that some wood was brought in, you believe, from infested areas or at least outside the area. Check and see if it is ash wood or what type of wood it is. If you can identify the tree by its bark, you know, that's the first thing to do before you rat on your neighbor and cause conflicts. But, yeah, definitely if they brought in ash wood, you want to get on that right away, you know, deal with it before those beetles escape.
And I suppose the other thing you can do is go to the company itself and say, hey, are you certified? What precautions have you taken to make sure that this is not contaminated? And I would think that given the situation where we have these pests being transported, and it is a delicate situation, that they would respond without defensiveness, because I would think a reputable company would not be defensive about that.
That's exactly right. If they're doing their thing, they're proud to be doing their thing, and they will tell you. If they say, oh, go away, or I don't know, or you got to talk to the boss or whatever, perhaps they don't know or they don't care. And, you know, the worst person in the world is one who doesn't care, and right behind him is one who doesn't know.
And, Bernie, obviously you care about this. So, you know, if you have a question about it.
Well, I think this whole thing should be brought out into people's, on TV more, that it's not even just going into a forest, a camp, and you're told to leave the wood there. I mean, it's. You know, there's hundreds of these people cutting trees part-time and that, and they don't even have the, you know, this is Pandora's box, it seems like.
Well, we're witnessing what, you know, Pandora's box being opened in the Midwest, because starting with the emerald ash borer in Michigan and spreading, Michigan and Ohio and spreading all over the Midwest. Let's face it, a lot of that happened because people did transport firewood. And I'll put the blame on myself, Bernie, because I know about this, and I know it's important not to transport firewood, and I haven't mentioned it enough on the show, even when I've been talking about the emerald ash borer problem. You forget. But you're right. It's important to say this, and I think, Guy, you brought out a really good point, which is people think, well, I'll take it to grandma's or whatever, or I'll leave it in the family, as if leaving it in the family is okay, even when you're crossing state lines. That's insane. You know, you can't account for that wood. So the idea is, unless you know where it's come from, and unless you know that it's absolutely free of pests, do not transport firewood.
Amen.
Bernie, listen, I appreciate you being patient. Do you have a subscription to Chicagoland Gardening Magazine?
No, I don't, but I think I will pick one up.
No. You have a subscription now. I'm giving you one.
You know, let me just say something, Mike. You know, I was in the lawn and garden business back in the 60s.
Yeah.
There was a company called Kahn Brothers Company.
I have no idea who that is, but go ahead.
George A. Davis, DG Supply. We used to buy bulk grass seed from Oregon and repackage it, sell it to Goldblatt. So I'm familiar with your business, and changed a lot from that time, but I just thought I'd just point it out.
Well, you know, you kind of dated yourself by saying Goldblatt's right there.
I mean, Walgreens.
Sure, sure.
All the chains and that, and, but, you know, like...
obviously, he might even be older than me.
But obviously, Bernie, you know, you're obviously, I can tell you're concerned, and that's why you called. And I think I really want to thank you for calling this to our attention. And I'm going to put you on hold. You talk to Heather, and we'll get you a subscription to Chicagoland Gardening Magazine, okay?
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks for calling, Bernie. And left on the phone is Guy Sternberg from Star Hill Forest Arboretum down in Menard County. And I found out this week that Menard County has exactly one traffic light.
And we're proud of it. We were the last county in Illinois to get a stoplight.
Were you really?
Now we're back up into the 19th century with everybody else.
Oh.
You know, Mike, I should have mentioned one other thing. Up in your area, Morton Arboretum, Edie Macker there, has been coordinating Emerald Ash Borer information for several years, and that would be a good contact for you to explore in terms of additional regulation and additional monitoring and information as to where they found this pest.
Yeah, Heather, while you're talking to Bernie, tell him to check with Morton Arboretum as well. Yeah, because I've had Edith on the show. I love having her on the program. We talk about this problem, and it's continuing to grow. And I warn folks that they're going to lose their. I'm not saying everybody's going to lose their ash trees. We don't even know. You know, is this going to end up being like American chestnut, which I talked about earlier on the program? Or is it going to be something a little different, maybe like American elm, where there's still a number of specimens left in the country? We just don't know how great the devastation is going to be, do we, Guy?
Well, no, we don't. The thing is that we are working, entomologists, researchers are working now to find natural enemies of this beetle that they can test, see if they're safe for release in the U.S. and try to get a handle on it. If you have an ash tree in your yard that you consider precious, that's really a nice tree and so forth, you can save it indefinitely with treatment. It's not cheap, but you can use either emamectin benzoate as a three-year return cycle, or you can use imidacloprid every year as a soil drench. So there are ways to deal with it on a tree-by-tree basis, but when you consider the millions of ash trees that are out there on city streets and in forests, the only way to solve that problem, and hopefully they will, is to bring in something that will parasitize or eat the borer and keep it in check.
Yeah, you're right, and that's the problem. If people want to save their trees, a lot of them don't have the money to afford the treatment. And what I tell them, and I hope this is not bad advice, is I say keep your tree as healthy as possible. So, you know, even healthy trees will succumb to Emerald ash borer, but a healthier tree might have a better chance of withstanding an attack, especially if there aren't as many of them in a particular area.
And a healthy tree also will withstand attacks from the ash lilac borer better, because that's a borer that attacks weakened trees. And if you have a borer in your ash tree, it's going to kill your ash tree. Whether it's a little green one or one of our native borers, it'll still do the job. So if you can protect the tree from other problems, and then monitor the situation, you know, check and see where the ash borers have been found. If they start to find them in your county or in your neighborhood, then you might want to consult with an arborist and see what are the options that you have in terms of preserving your tree. And you can do this with American elms, too, with Dutch elm disease. There are injections that you can use on those elms every couple of years, and they will keep the disease away. It's a fungicide injection for the ash borers, an insecticide injection, and what they call macroinfusion. You can keep them on life support, and you know, we planned on down here in Arboretum to do this for about 10 years. And if in that time there's hope on the horizon that some of these pests of the ash borer are going to come in and control them, great. If not, well, you know, it was a gamble, and we'll have to let it go. We can't afford to do it indefinitely. Maybe just one or two really rare trees. We have more than 1,500 different types of trees here, and we just can't.
No, and as Edith and I say, cover your ash.
You betcha.
That's what you got to do, and you can't help having a little bit of morbid humor there with that problem. All right, listen, Guy, I'll get back to you in just a second. I got to take care of some business. We'll get to what's happening down at Star Hill Forest Arboretum in Menard County, the county with one traffic light in just a second. Meanwhile, the November-December issue of Chicagoland Gardening Magazine is officially on the newsstands, and here are just some of the goodies you'll find inside. Tis the season for indoor plants, and there's a story on the best trailing plants for your home, including spider plant, which is not a Dracaena, as we have pointed out, but is related to the lily. Of course, even outdoor plants can look good with a covering of snow, and plantsman extraordinaire Roy Diblick tells you which ones you should add in the spring so they'll look good next winter. And there's a tear-out 2010 Gardener's Calendar featuring photos by Chicagoland Gardening's Ron Capick. He is the official photographer for Chicagoland Gardening, takes great photos. You can take out this little calendar, put it up on your wall. It's got little tips at the bottom about what to do each month of the year in terms of indoor and outdoor plants, and you'll like to have that around. Of course, there are regular features like what to do in the garden, your gardening questions, and the regional reports. And now you can find Chicagoland Gardening Magazine all over Chicagoland. In fact, more than 800 new newsstand locations have been added in the last couple of months. And get your voice warmed up. My annual holiday, and I mean me, I write these, my annual holiday hort sing-along features your favorite carols with gardening lyrics. And, of course, Guy Sternberg, you've read some of those. Did they make you want to give up Christmas forever?
Oh, it kept me awake all night.
Pick up a copy of Chicagoland Gardening Magazine today, or better yet, subscribe. Find it on the web at www.chicagolandgardening.com, or give the office a call during business hours at 866-806-1498 and tell them that Mike sent you. While I'm at it, hey, let's do a tip from the Care of Trees. Did you know that in 2009, the Care of Trees was recognized for the fifth year as a company that cares? This year, 37 organizations were named nationwide. Honor roll recipients are selected for their deep commitment to elevating the quality of work environment for their employees and the quality of life for people in the broader community. Now, the Care of Trees fit that. They're also a company that cares, as I mentioned earlier. They will come out and look at your tree, tell you what you got, tell you what problems you might have, help you figure out what to do. On my block, there was a tree in a lot down at the corner that seems to be collapsing. I had Sean Kingzett from the Care of Trees come out and take a look at it. He put together an official report that I'm going to send to the city of Chicago so they know the tree's collapsing. And this is the kind of thing they do. Now, it doesn't always have to be a legal report like Sean did. Sometimes you just want to know what you have in your yard and whether it's healthy. And the idea is they'll come out, they'll take a look at it, often for free, and then help you figure out what to do next for your tree care. So consider making the Care of Trees your permanent partner in enhancing the value of your landscape. Whether you want to make sure all is well with the trees in your yard or you're changing your landscaping, invite the certified arborist at the Care of Trees to take a look. Go to thecareoftrees.com or call 847-394-4220. The Care of Trees, their business is people and their love for trees.
A one, two, three.
This is the Mike Novak Show on Chicago's Progressive Talk, AM and FM. And as I said earlier, we're featuring music today from Red Horse and the Stoneflies. Information is up on my website, Mike Novak, MikeNowak.net. I don't know, is this your kind of music, Guy Sternberg?
Well, I I'll take the fifth.
You don't like a little fiddle in your with your breakfast cereal? Okay.
Well, I'm into the extremes. Either Def Leppard or Tchaikovsky.
Def Leppard or Tchaikovsky?
I like him.
Well, let's get some Tchaikovsky on the program, okay?
I will bring it next week.
I bet you got Def Leppard, too, right?
Oh, sure do.
All right, bring it. See, we should have had it today. We weren't prepared for this.
That's okay. I'll do with fiddle. Fiddle is cool.
At any rate, you continue to rake in the awards for Star Hill Forest Arboretum. And you guys are, what, about 12 miles away from Springfield?
We're 12 miles northwest of Springfield on the way to Lincoln's New Salem in Menard County with one stoplight.
And I didn't even look. I know Kathleen was working on it today. We went out to your place this week and saw the Arboretum, and it's really amazing what you guys are doing there. And then went to New Salem, which... You know, it seems a little kitschy, but it sure is fun. I mean, it's not. You know, that's the other thing. It's very tastefully done. The reconstruction of the buildings from Abraham Lincoln's days in New Salem, including putting them on the original foundations. One of the original buildings is there, so you get to see where Lincoln lived and worked and. It's kind of awe-inspiring, and I like going there at this time of year when nobody else is around.
Yeah, it's also great to go in the winter when there's a few inches of snow on there and no one else is there and there are no tracks, and you can just see it just like 1830. But, you know, we have a very small county, and Lincoln is our thing. He spent more of his formative time here than anywhere else in the world. So anything that was associated with Lincoln, of course, was documented by word of mouth, by family histories and news articles and so on. So we know so much about the history of this little county and as it affected Lincoln and New Salem. There's just a lot of information there that's been kept that otherwise would have been lost in the dust of time.
Yeah. And one thing that a lot other things that would be lost in the dust of time are certain kinds of trees that you are preserving and also bringing in new hybrids. I mean, you've got some amazing stuff at Star Hill, and tell me about the latest achievement. You were picked to be on a very exclusive list.
The American Public Gardens Association, which is the professional organization for botanic gardens and arboreta, you know, throughout North America, has a program where they will investigate and certify and recognize the gardens throughout North America who have what they would consider the best reference collections of a particular genus, you know, maple collection, rhododendron collection, whatever. And because oaks are so diverse and grow in so many different habitats, they've decided to make that a multi-collection designation. And it's part of the North American Plant Collection Consortium, NAPCC, and we've just been added as the 16th garden as a reference collection for oaks in North America.
So there's only, in North America, there's only 16... places that are part of this consortium, and you're the 16th.
Right. Actually, we have three in Illinois. Illinois is a hotbed for oaks. The Morton Arboretum and Chicago Botanic Garden are also members of this elite group.
So that's very prestigious. So you got to have something downstate, and that's where you come in.
That's where we come in. We actually have more different types of oaks than most of the collections, but a lot of them have been around a lot longer, and their trees are mature. So every collection offers something different, but you need to have the trees from documented origins, have searchable databases, have labeling. I mean, there's a lot to it more than just planting acorns.
And another thing that happened recently, and a couple of years ago, basically, was it a couple of years ago that you got involved with Illinois College?
Right. We started this arboretum 35 years ago, and we know that we won't be young forever. And so we decided, you know, what should we do? Should we die and let this place become a shopping center or what? So we were looking around for some way to perpetuate what we're doing here and, you know, the gift that keeps on giving, so to speak. And Illinois College is just a little bit west of us in Jacksonville. They're the oldest college in Illinois. They have a dynamite biology program. And their president and his first lady and their biology departments But they were extremely interested in having an arboretum for the college, and they actually called me over to show them how to start one at the college, where they have very limited available land. And then we got to talk about, well, what have you done? And I showed them, I took them over here and showed them what we'd done. Oh, could we bring our students here? So this sort of snowballed, and over about a three-year process, we became comfortable with each other, and we're now the official arboretum for Illinois College.
Oh, that's fabulous. How many specimens of, let me just say, how many different kinds of oaks would you say you have on the arboretum?
We have about half of the world's oaks. Many of the oaks of the world are tropical. We do maintain about 100 different species of tropical oaks in containers that we bring into greenhouses every winter. All told, we have 250-plus different types of oak trees here, and that's about one-fourth of all the trees that we've planted here. We have another 150 or so other genera, you know, maples and ashes and firs and so on.
And unless the folks listening think that this was all ready to go when they started working on the land, obviously you've planted so many of these yourself, but as it's 40 acres and what, about 30 is developed now?
Yeah, it's actually 48 acres, and about two-thirds of that is either developed and or maintained as native forest. There are some old growth trees along the creek bluff. We do have about 15 acres that are still available for expansion, and we're slowly eating our way into those 15 acres.
Right. What I was going to say is that, you know, a guy walks us through where he's planted stuff and points over to a soybean field and says, yeah, that'll be part of the arboretum at some point. But it's not now. There's still soybeans there, and that's what's interesting, is that you're taking the farmland and reverting it, you know, back to trees and other kinds of plants, and it's just it's wonderful to see. Tell me real quick before I let you go about the one of the plants that fascinated me was the pine that came from Lincoln's tomb. Explain this.
Well, I worked with Oak Ridge Cemetery, where Lincoln is buried, for years, helping them to document their trees and plant additional trees that were propagated from historic oaks, from rare oaks around the world, and so on. And in looking through their board of managers' minutes from the 1860s to get a feel for the history of the place, I saw one entry where they said they appropriated money to buy some evergreens from Phoenix Nursery in Bloomington, Illinois, to beautify the grounds. And that was 1862, and in 1865, when Lincoln was buried there, the photographs showing Lincoln's funeral show some of these little white pine trees, and you can tell by the growth that they had been planted a couple of years ago, because they didn't grow much that year, and then they grew more the next year, and then by 1865, they were growing normally again. Well, those trees grew on, of course, and one of them got to be about 100 feet tall, and was struck by lightning. And the lightning didn't kill it. It made a streak down the trunk, as it often does. But from that point upward, it became a broom, or a very dense growth. It was a mutation caused by the electrical charge. So I had a friend of mine climb the tree, throw me down some sign woods. We took them to Rich Iyer up there at Fox Willow Pines in your area. He got one to graft, which he gave back to me, and we have that growing here now. And in the meantime, a tornado took out the top of the original tree, so really the only one that's left is this graft that we have. We've named it Phoenix, both for the nursery source and because it was born of fire from lightning.
Isn't that amazing? The pine tree from Lincoln's tomb, it gets struck by lightning, creates a mutation, you get the mutation, you get it planted, and then the tree... again, what happened to the tree?
Well, the top of it got blown out by a tornado. So
okay,
the tree is still there. The bottom two-thirds of it is still there, but the broom part is gone.
And so you have that only mutation left from this. It's just a strange and fascinating story and pretty cool.
We try to do this with a lot of trees. We have other historic things preserved here, too.
Well, I got to let you go, and I want to thank you for calling for talking. I called you. So, for talking.
You can call anytime.
Happy to do it, to talk to you, Guy. If you ever get a chance, you're down Springfield Way. You're going to go to see the Lincoln Museum, but, you know, go see Star Hill Forest Arboretum in Menard. Visit the only stoplight in town. That would be cool. That's in Petersburg. Say hi to Guy and Edie for me. And thanks. Oh, and Guy, next time I'm staying over, you got to do something about those cats. You got six cats in the house or whatever, and it's... They're killing me.
Let me guess, the allergies, right?
Yeah, I was sneezing for days.
So we'll have to build you a special hotel on the ground.
Okay, please do. All right, Guy, I will talk to you later.
Okay, thanks, Mike.
Bye-bye. This is the Mike Novak Show on Chicago's Progressive Talk, AM and FM. We're going to get to Connie in just a second. Like it or not, the holiday season is upon us, and Sid's Greenhouses invites you to attend their annual Christmas open house starting Saturday, November 14th, that's next Saturday, through the 21st, with a special preview night this Friday from 5 to 8 p.m. at their stores in Palos Hills and Bolingbrook. There's lots planned for this week-long celebration, including tasty holiday refreshments, free pictures with Santa, seminars, door prizes, and perhaps best of all, up to 60% off Christmas decor to help make your holiday celebrations extra special. SIDS has the most extensive selection of Christmas and holiday decor in Chicagoland. They have over 100 styles of lifelike artificial trees in sizes up to 12 feet. They have dozens of theme-decorated trees loaded with thousands of unique collectible ornaments to choose from. They also have beautiful wreaths, garlands, and Christmas arrangements to decorate your home or office. And it's all up to 60% off during SID's Holiday Preview Open House, starting this Friday at 5 p.m. This Friday at 5 p.m., it all kicks off. Visit SIDSonline.com for the details and to download a coupon for $10 off your purchase. SIDS, Chicagoland's premier garden centers, nursery, and florist, are located in Palos Hills on Southwest Highway and in Bolingbrook on Napier Plainfield Road at Hassert Boulevard. All right, let's do a little roulette here. Back to our CD from Red Horse and the Stone Flies, and it goes like this. Mike Novak Show on Chicago's Progressive Talk, AM and FM, coming up at 10 o'clock. The Mighty House guys are here. Right now, I am going to line one and bringing Connie Spreen. How are you doing, Connie?
I'm fine. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Connie was on the show a few weeks ago. We were talking about the 61st Street Garden down in the Hyde Park Woodlawn community. And the efforts to save the garden, University of Chicago was planning to use it as a staging spot for some construction they were going to do. But the garden, I would say, is fairly iconic in the neighborhood. Where do we stand at the moment, Connie?
Well, for the last few months, we have been trying to engage the University of Chicago in a series of conversations about the value of the garden as an asset, not just to the community, but also to the University of Chicago itself. And we have done this on individual bases with people at the university, because it is not a monolithic institution. There are a lot of wonderful people who are there, and very interesting and very creative, who also think that it's not necessary to do the staging as it's currently being proposed. But the word that has come down is that the university wants to take over the entire site, which it does not need to do, but it would like to do the staging for a building that will be to the north, on the north end of the block, on 60th Street and Dorchester, and the garden being primarily on 61st and Black, 61st and Dorchester.
Mm-hmm. But
go ahead.
No, you tell me.
Okay, so far they haven't given us any really clear and compelling reasons and arguments why they would see the staging as being absolutely necessary there. They have put forth a few different statements, citing safety as one of them, the safety of the gardeners, but we find that one somewhat difficult because They'll be running all of the construction staging on 61st Street past the Andrew Carnegie Elementary School, where there are many, many children, you know, coming and going, and as well as all of the customers that come to the experimental station, of which I'm the director. And they've also decided that they don't want to damage plots in the garden, which did happen when they built a Helmut Jahn chiller plant just to the east. But we don't accept that argument either because it doesn't make sense. It's illogical to say that they don't want to damage plots, so they will demolish the entire garden. So we've come to the conclusion that there are reasons that haven't been put forth because cost is one of them, and everyone does understand that. And I should have prefaced everything by saying that if we recognize, you know, it is University of Chicago property. No one disputes that in any way, shape, or form. And the gardeners who have been there, the gardener has been there for 10 years, are grateful for the use of the property. It's just that what we are trying to enable them to see is that what has been built there is a wonderful asset that they did not anticipate, and nor did we in starting it, that it would grow into be such an important, as you say, kind of an icon in this area and has brought together people who would never, ever have come into contact with one another in what is very much a historically divided neighborhood between Hyde Park, which is affluent, and Woodlawn, which is a very underserved and has been a low-income community for the last 50 or 60 years. So the community garden brings all of these people together.
Yeah. And Connie, and I'm glad you mentioned this. I should have introduced her as a co-founder and executive director of Experimental Station on the South Side. And all this, the story of this, what's happening at the 61st Street Garden is on my website on this week's show at MikeNovak.net, including articles from the Sun-Times, the Tribune, Hyde Park Herald. There's a website called the Invisible Institute, and they're doing kind of a video presentation on this.
Right, right. The Driehaus Foundation has funded a kind of video documentary of the garden and people who have been gardeners over the years, how they tell their story about their experience in this space.
Mm-hmm. There's even, I linked to a blog entry by my friend Beth Botts, who has worked for 20 years at the Chicago Tribune and sometimes co-hosts this show, about what happened to 61st. And she writes it as a cautionary tale, which is, if you don't own the land, this can happen. Now, as you said, you recognize that the University of Chicago has owned the land, and what happens is wonderful things happen, and people think that perhaps these things can go on forever, but when development comes a-calling, this is the kind of thing that is likely to happen.
Right. Well, I guess what we would state, and I was one of the people who helped to negotiate that arrangement with the university, is that the conversations that we had were about when they wanted to build on it, that they would give us advance notice of that, and so that we could vacate the lot. This is not a situation where they're actually going to build on it. There is staging area to the north that they could certainly use. So this is a to build a building on the north end of the block, and the community garden is on the south end of the block. And there is a fair amount of vacant space in between that could certainly be used as a staging area.
So you're saying that there's really, in your mind, in the minds of people who have worked the garden, there's really no reason why you couldn't preserve the garden at this point and still allow for a staging area.
Right, and preserve the garden in some form. You know, everyone, I think, would recognize if there were a real need that it could be smaller, it could be reconfigured, it could be, you know, there could be many different things that could happen, and we would be very open to that kind of conversation. But it's not a conversation that we have been able to engage in yet, and mm-hmm. we are hoping to do that.
Well, if there are any folks who live down that way and, you know, happen to know the movers and shakers at University of Chicago, you can give me a call at 773-838-9278. Because I know those movers and shakers. They listen to my show. They're ready to call. And the people who know the Movers and Shakers.
All Movers and Shakers listen to your show.
I know that.
Mike.
I know. I'm aware of that. Certainly in the community garden world. I'm the only community garden show on the air, I dare say, in Chicago. Or at least highlights those kinds of discussions. 773-838-9278. Well,
may I mention something? That there's going to be a community meeting.
Oh yeah, that's where I was headed next, okay. Connie, on this. But go ahead, mention that because out of all of this, you've been trying to save this, and the reason you're on the show is because I got a notice the other day from the Master Gardeners of Cook County about this community meeting, and it didn't say much except that there was going to be a community meeting. Thursday, November 12th at Carnegie School, 1414 East 61st Place in Chicago. And I put two and two together. I went, I wonder if this has something to do with the 61st Street Garden. And so, of course, I called you, and lo and behold, it does. So tell me about the meeting.
So we've been actually very pleased that Alderman Cochran, who is the alderman of the 20th Ward and of Woodlawn, has stepped forward and has taken this leadership role to create community gardens in Woodlawn. So what we are hoping to do in the future, this meeting being kind of a launching pad, I think, for conversations about that, how things will happen, how people might be involved, and also about the 61st Street Community Garden and how we might collectively enable the university to think about it differently. But so it's a meeting that Alderman Cochran has called because he would like to play this leadership role. And I think one of the things that we will do to help him in this endeavor is to work with NeighborSpace, work with some of these other organizations to help support him in doing this so that we have what you're talking about, you know, development follows on the heels of community gardens. And one of the problems with community gardens is that you invest so much of yourself in creating the space, and what ends up happening is that as soon as it becomes a more valuable area, all of those developers decide to develop that property, and you lose it. And so there's a hesitation on individuals' parts as well to get involved in a community garden because it does take a lot of investment. The fact that the 61st Street Community Garden is so successful has everything to do with the untold hours of volunteer labor. The fact that the person who has managed the garden is a landscaper, Jack Spicer, and he's managed it for 10 years. He brings in his crew. We have planted trees. They have done landscaping, flowers all around the periphery. We put in the fencing. There's been a big investment on the part of the community as well in this. And the reason that it is such, this is the community side of the community garden, that it's been so successful in terms of the community that it's built is because that has been fostered and nurtured and cultivated, just like the plants over time.
So one of the things that's happening here is that, you know, maybe what good comes out of this is that people understand what they're losing, and even if you can't save 61st, maybe some other gardens will spring up in that area, and I'm glad that Alderman Cochran is getting on board with this and bringing people together to talk about this because I've talked about urban agriculture on the show before. As I said, I went down to Springfield to talk to some people from the Illinois Local Food and Farms Task Force about that this week. And we're only going to have more of this. So we need to establish the ground rules for this. Can I bring in a real quick phone call? Connie, let's go to line two. Is this Tech?
This is Tech.
Hi, I understand you grew up by that garden.
And she knows exactly where I grew up, the courtyard on the corner, 6103 Southwood Line. Jim Burris, the Irvings. Yes, I remember that garden quite fondly. In fact, my dad and my sister still stays on the block. My dad to the right of Alderman Cochran. And my sister to one of the houses to the left of the garden. Connie is absolutely right. There's lots of vacant space on that block that could be used as a staging location. This garden is very serene. It's for the beautification of the block. And as she said, this particular block was the Woodlawn area for a very long time. Two streets to either side of 61st and Woodlawn, University and Kimbark have been very depressed for years, And this is something that does bring hope to this area. And so any support, that, and Mike, I just heard your show all. I had to admit, I don't listen so much on Sundays, and I had no idea this was going on. I'm calling from DeKalb, but I know where you're, what you're talking about and the location. I have family that's still there. So all support that anyone could bring in to negotiate or stop this from happening, I hope it happens.
Well, I'm glad you're listening out there in DeKalb because we've got that 92.5 signal booming out that way.
Absolutely.
And see, I just keep broadcasting and hoping more people discover that I'm here. Connie, did you want to comment on what Tech has to say?
I so appreciate what she did have to say because there are people who are not, who are invested in the garden because they have been gardeners, but then there are also people who recognize the value of the garden who are not gardeners. There are people who live in the neighborhood and who respect what is there for what it is actually doing and the role that it is actually playing in the community. So I definitely appreciate what you have said.
Well, Tech, I'm glad you called, and even though you're now out in DeKalb, that, you know, you understand the, as you said, the important word, I think, about this garden was hope, that it it represents hope, and even if, and I hope they can hold on to it, speaking of the word hope.
One more quick comment.
Sure.
I'd like to say that the grocery stores on the 63rd side of Woodline, down there where they've all been removed, depressed for housing, so a garden is definitely something that that community needs for people who can't afford to go into the Hyde Park area and go to the more expensive places. This is probably somewhere that people could come and get fresh fruit, vegetables, or what have you right there on this block or however the system works.
Yeah,
you're
saying exactly why we need more community gardens. We have to get food to the underserved communities. And I'm so glad you call. I got to run, but I'm so glad you're listening out in DeKalb. Call anytime, listen anytime. I appreciate talking to you.
Bye. Thank you.
Can I
make one quick comment?
Yes.
One of the things that I think is so important. There is a.
You still with me?
Yes, I am.
Okay, go ahead.
There is a food access issue, which I think is very important. Woodlawn is a food desert, and community gardens certainly serve that need, and they are very important in doing so. Woodlawn has not been able to attract supermarkets, and I wouldn't encourage Woodlawn to attract supermarkets because we have started a farmers market ourselves, and there are many other ways of bringing food into the neighborhood that are better for the neighborhood than a supermarket, that create community, that create links between people. And I think that one of the most important aspects, again, of a community garden is a community part of the garden.
Yes.
Is that it enables people to know each other and have contact with each other and discover that they have a lot in common. And I think that one of the things that we see so often in broken neighborhoods, from block to block, the kids can't speak to each other because they're in rival gangs.
Right.
The real kind of community has broken down, and civic life has broken down. And I think what community gardens help to do is to rebuild that civic life.
And the meeting is Thursday, November 12th at Carnegie School, 1414 East 61st Place in Chicago. Connie, keep me posted. We'll talk more about this. I'm going to be talking a lot more about community gardens on the show, and I want you to be part of that conversation.
Great. Thank you so much.
Take care now.
You too.
And, of course, all the information is on the website at MikeNovak.net. Now, since 1997, WRD Environmental has been creating healthy, sustainable landscapes that are both beautiful and responsible to future generations. You could say WRD is in the business of transformation. Sometimes it's through projects like the Lincoln Park South Pond, for which WRD is part of a team that is turning the zoo's popular pond into a model for sustainable landscape solutions, habitat restoration, and environmental learning. Other times, it's through leadership and organizations like MELA, the Midwest Ecological Landscaping Association, which is working to green up the landscape industry so that sustainable design, materials, and methods are the professional standard. Sometimes, the transformations are of the people themselves. WRD is a partner with the Chicago Department of Environment in managing Green Corps Chicago, which provides job training in the green industry, electronics recycling, and home weatherization. For innovative, sustainable, sustainable transformations, choose WRD Environmental, located at the Chicago Center for Green Technology and online at WRDEnvironmental.com. Next week, well, next Sunday is America Recycles Day. You know we're going to be talking about that. I'm going to have Mike Mitchell from the Illinois Recycling Association. We'll talk about recycling coming up next. The Mighty House, they're beating down the door outside. Joe Builder and Ron Cowgill, and of course, I will see you next Sunday at 8 on Chicago's Progressive Talk.